I want to welcome you to part three, Echoes of War, Jihadism and the American Divide. In this section, we're going to deal with controversial issues of fighting a proportional war, Israel's burden in this war, the questions of apartheid and colonization, a two-state solution, and what's happening here at home. I'm Paul Johnson. I'm just a typical optimistic American who believes that America is still a cause for good. So if you're ready to get started, push that subscribe button. Let's go.
Destiny. Destiny. You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. 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 You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Now again, as I did in the other sections, I'm going to start with my bias. I'm an independent voter. I spent my life in politics and business, and I've been around the world studying genocides and major conflicts. I've authored a book, or co-authored one, called Addictive Ideologies, that's focused on how radical ideologies, including jihadism and the extremism on the right and left, have created an incredible danger for Western civilized society. Second, I don't have any justification for the horrors of war. If you're appalled by the images you're seeing on TV regarding the war in Gaza, it's as you should be. We should all be appalled. But you don't avoid war with tropes. A deeper understanding of what really drives this war is our key to helping stop it. All I can really give you is a deeper look at the facts and the ability to ask some questions around this war. And last, I want to encourage you to see a large distinction between Muslims and jihadists. There are 2 billion Muslims on the planet, and only a very small part are jihadist. We'd all be better served if we distance ourselves from them. So let's go to the first question, proportionality. Can war be proportional? And if so, what war is the right example? The Israel-Gaza War of 2023 raises profound questions about the nature of warfare and the concept of proportionality in conflict. During this conflict, casualties were significantly high on both sides. Israeli sources reported around 1,332 deaths, including civilian and military personnel. While in Gaza, health ministries report the Palestinian toll at somewhere around 30,000 as of this reporting, with 60,000 injured. This disproportionality is eclipsed by the civilians massacred, by the young women who were raped, or the children who were murdered on October 7th at various locations, including the music festival and the kibbutz and the unarmed farming community. You know, I admit to it, I'm just not really sure how you calculate proportionality. What do you count for a rape? Does that just count for 1-to-1, or is there some other ratio that you would utilize for it? The surprise nature of the attack by Hamas, as detailed in various sources, prompted a severe response from Israel, which included extensive airstrikes targeting Hamas compounds, command centers, tunnels, and other military targets. The scale and intensity of Israelis' response certainly bring to the forefront the debate on the proportionality in war. The concepts of proportionality in this conflict are complex, often involving the balancing of military objectives against the potential for civilian casualties. In the context of asymmetric warfare, where combatants are embedded with civilian populations, distinguishing between combatants and non-combatants becomes extremely difficult. This complexity is further highlighted in urban warfare settings like Gaza, where civilian infrastructure and military targets are often intertwined. The aftermath of the war leaves a lasting impact on both Israel and Palestinian populations. This conflict, like many others, challenged the notion of morality and justice in war. You know, I have no doubt that Germany and Japan in the 1940s saw glory in war and believed that they had the right to a moral cause. In the 1860s, the South felt the same. Sometimes a greater cause comes from war, but on the issue of proportionality, as the ability to judge one side or the other fails any historical test of logic. This is also true with the pursuit of political objectives through military means. best I can do on this one is to agree that war is bad. The complexity of distinguishing between Hamas's militants and innocent civilians in Gaza, particularly during the recent Israeli conflict, is a significant challenge. Now, I don't have to answer this one, because while I see a lot of other people who point out the problem, I'm really not seeing anybody else who's really addressing how. One option is for Israel to just leave. As long as Hamas has Israeli prisoners, and as long as Sinwar is alive, I don't really see that happening. I'm not too sure that it's fair to even ask them to. But I am sure we wouldn't leave if this same situation happened to us as Americans. Hamas was elected in 2005, and they maintain significant support amongst Gazans, and that complicates the narrative. Instances of civilian participations in the abuse of hostages, as seen in some of the footages, highlight the blurred lines between combatants and civilians in such conflicts. This phenomenon is not unique to Gaza, but it has been observed in a various of historical contexts, including Nazi Germany, where civilian support for the regime complicated post-war interpretations of innocence and guilt. In this context, ensuring the protection and provisions of aid to civilians has become a daunting task. International agencies like the WHO and the Red Cross work tirelessly to provide aid despite those challenges, but the task is monumental. The situation in Gaza, with its deep-rooted political, socioeconomic, and health issues, mirrors the complexity of modern warfare, where we distinguish between the aggressor and the victim is oftentimes not black and white. UNRWA, the UN organization, has been the lifeline to Palestinians. They had Hamas members who took part in the October 7th as part of their group. And the UN headquarters in Gaza being connected to tunnels allegedly also complicate the situation. Because we label Hamas a terrorist organization, many people see them like the 19 terrorists who hijacked planes in 9/11. But this is a real army, and this is a real war. The conflict involving Hamas and its military wing in the Gaza Strip against Israel is marked by complex historical, political, and military dimensions. Established in 1992, the Qassam Brigades operate as the military arm of Hamas, engaging in a range of military actions against Israeli targets. Estimates are the Hamas wing has over 30 to 40,000 soldiers. Hamas's founding in 1987 as an offshoot of Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood has governed the Gaza Strip since 2007. The organization has a dual nature, combining political governance with armed resistance. Its military activities have included rocket attacks and, historically, suicide bombings aimed at Israeli military as well as civilian targets. The Israeli military says that over 5,000 missiles have been fired towards the country since the war began. Israeli intelligence in 2021 estimated that Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, another militant group operating out of Gaza, had some 30,000 missiles in their arsenal. Since 2001, Palestinian militants have launched tens of thousands of rockets on Israel. Some places in Israel are protected by the Iron Dome, but many other places are not. The international community has widely condemned the use of indiscriminate attacks against civilians, considering them violations of international law. The United Nations, among other international bodies, has specifically criticized these tactics. Israel's response to those tactics have included targeted assassinations, airstrikes, and ground operations aimed at degrading the military capabilities of Hamas and the Qassam Brigades. These responses have led to significant casualties and destruction in Gaza, with no real evidence that they're changing the mindset of the jihadist. Numerous missile attacks have been reported to originate from locations such as hospitals and refugee camps, notably the Ash-Shatai camp, home to over 40,000 residents and established in 1948. Evidence, including video footage, suggests that Hamas utilizes these densely populated areas for military operations, including the deployment of RPG teams that pop up at random to strike IDF forces. Israel, in response to these tactics, during its 2014 military operations, opted for precision strikes and the use of joint direct attack munitions, or what are called JDAMs, over conventional artillery. This decision was based on the need for vertical deployment of munitions, which JDAMs provide, minimizing collateral damage compared to the broader impact area of artillery. Despite these efforts, still significant destruction of infrastructure has been unavoidable. Hamas's strategy involves asymmetric warfare, which is deliberately intertwining civilian infrastructure with military objectives. It's a tactic that complicates the Israeli Defense Force's measured responses. This approach aims to provoke a broader conflict, leveraging the complexities of engaging in densely populated areas. A main point of controversy has been the targeting of Al-Shifa Hospital, a large facility that operates in this area and has been contentious with the claims of Hamas using the premise for military purposes, including tunnel networks beneath the hospital. This situation presents a moral and legal quandary. The Geneva Convention protects medical facilities and refugees from attack under Article 18. However, the use of such locations for military purposes by Hamas challenged these protections under Article 19, making Hamas guilty of war crimes and making them a legitimate target. Regardless, heated debates over the legitimacy of the targets and the appropriate response by the IDF have ensued. The aftermath of the explosion at the Al-Shafia Hospital on October 17th resulted in significant casualties, further exemplifies the complexity of the conflict. While it's still in contention if a command center was below the hospital, what is not in contention is that there are several stories of tunnels below the hospital. There are some people who justified these tunnels under hospitals and schools, believing that Hamas has no other option, although that justification creates an incredible moral contradiction, and it becomes impossible to criticize Israel under those circumstances. But the real story here was the consequences from a New York Times story gone awry. Accusations against Israel for the attack was widespread, although disputed figures on the death tolls and origins of the explosion have fueled controversy and an international outcry. This narrative not only illustrates the harsh realities of modern asymmetric warfare, but it also highlights the profound ethical dilemmas faced by all parties involved. The intertwining of civilian and military spheres by Hamas complicates the IDF's operational decisions, where the international community grapples with the broader implications of such tactics on the principles of international law and humanitarian protection. On October 17th, an explosion occurred at a hospital, resulting in a tragic loss of life. Hospital staff from Hamas attributed over 470 fatalities to the incidents, and they directly blamed Israel. Contrarily, the United States offered a significant low casualty estimate, around 100 individuals. In the immediate aftermath, Hamas accused Israel's Joint Direct Attack Munitions, the JDAMs, of being responsible for the blast. The rapid dissemination of this narrative by the media, before any type of verification of facts existed, ignited widespread condemnation of Israel. Notably, the New York Times, upon reviewing evidence provided by the United States government alongside direct video footage, issued an editorial acknowledging an over-reliance on initial reports by Hamas. Nonetheless, the preliminary coverage had already catalyzed global protest, including riots at a U.S. embassy and university. Amid these events, deeply troubling expressions of anti-Semitism emerged, exemplified by incidents in Sydney. Yet, the bombing didn't seem to come from the Israelis. Right-wing politicians of Israel don't help when they talk about using nukes or flattening Gaza or to relocate them. But to be fair to Netanyahu, is often blamed for right-wing rhetoric, in real time refuted most of these allegations, and that's rarely given attention. But as I said, I don't see a good example of war. But maybe the best evidence that Israel's not responding with a campaign against civilians was a decision by the UN regarding Israel taking part in a genocide. As it has come to Israel in this war, the UN has been a bit morally bankrupt. However, when asked by the South African government to charge Israel with genocide, at the request of the court to mandate Israel stop all aggression, the UN court agreed to hold a trial in a year, but to not call for stops of acts of aggression. While they did ask question regarding statements by politicians, superficially right-wing politicians who've made bombastic comments as mentioned above, it's hard to see how this group at the UN, who had access to the intimate details of the war, including the acts of Hamas on October the 7th, was not a victory for Israel in the court of world opinion. While some have spun it as a loss for Israel, the most anti-war group in the world agreed to hold trial in a year and not demand a ceasefire after watching the evidence. In politics, that's called a signal. On the issue of colonization, one must consider the complex tapestry of history when addressing the question of whether Israel acts as a colonizer or an occupier, and in so doing, whether this mirrors a global historical pattern. Throughout history, the establishment of nations often involved the displacement of preceding people. Native American tribes, for instance, engaged in territorial conflicts long before European colonization. Similarly, the rise of Islam under the leadership of Prophet Muhammad involved the expansion and displacement of various groups in the Arabian Peninsula. The historical presence of Jews in the land currently known as Israel predicates most others, entwining deeply in the region's history. To believe that Israel is a colonizer, you just have your history wrong. Because as we pointed out earlier, in the aftermath of World War II, the international community, led by the United States and the United Nations, sought a resolution to the Jewish question by endorsing the establishment of a Jewish homeland. This decision was influenced in part by the impracticality of returning Jewish survivors to their former homes in Europe and Arab nations now occupied by others. Moreover, Jewish communities faced expulsion, murder, and torture, and displacement from Arab countries during those years, further complicating the situation. The idea that Israel is an apartheid state was addressed earlier. This is certain. Muslims in Israel proper have all the same right as Jews. If this was being done for race motive, why would they allow that? The answer is much deeper than these titles presume. Gaza was colonized, just wasn't colonized by Israel. In fact, Israel didn't occupy it after 2005, and they gave it back to the Palestinian people to decide on their own government. But they were colonized by Hamas, whose leaders are now living in Qatar, reaping billions of dollars from the people who were there, all the while pointing their finger at the Jews. We can only hope that one day the Palestinians set aside jihadism in Gaza that has been used by other men to define maybe more their greed than adherence to Muslim principles. It's been used to rob them. American Jews, a soft justification for October the 7th by talking about Hamas being oppressed. So let's try and tackle this question. What role does oppression play in the acts of October the 7th? Consider this. The world is home to over 2 billion Muslims, distinct from jihadists amongst them, with over 60 groups designated as foreign terrorist organizations by the U.S. State Department. Included in these are names like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, who American soldiers have fought bravely against. Other groups like Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Houthis are also featured prominently. The ideologies of these groups are radical, fostering a worldview that categorizes individuals into oppressors and the oppressed, thereby justifying violence through dehumanization. My colleague, Dr. Basha, a psychologist specializing in the evaluation of individuals who've committed severe acts of terrorism, many within the jihadist category, and I have explored the concept of addictive ideologies in our work. Our studies reveal that these ideologies, which lead to violence, strip individuals of their agencies, merging their identities into a collective nature. In Gaza, under Hamas's governance, indoctrination into such ideologies begins in the public educational system, creating a worldview that is difficult to escape. They aren't given just religious studies based on Muslim faith. They're indoctrinated into jihadism, as seen here by the pictures from routers involving the indoctrination of kindergartners. This perspective suggests that merely granting Gazan statehood will not dismantle those entrenched in jihadist views. Again, consider the case of Osama bin Laden. Was it oppression that caused him to act? While his actions were devoid of rape and direct brutalization associated with October the 7th, it was still unimaginable to Americans that someone would intentionally hijack planes and fly it into buildings, killing over 3,000 people, many Muslims. This did not stem from oppression, given that he comes from one of the wealthiest families in the world. It stems from jihadism. And Gaza, despite receiving substantial subsidies, literally in the hundreds of billions of dollars, far exceeding those given to other refugees worldwide, could have built a Singapore or maybe a Monte Carlo for that money. Instead, they put that money into a military and into an underground tunnel system, a system that is well known by their public. The rationale behind the extremist actions, whether it be to harm innocents or using human shields, aligns with the beliefs of Hamas in achieving paradise through violence. This mindset serves the interest of the Gaza elite, who divert attention from their corruption by fostering animosity towards external enemies. The moral quandary we face is combating an adversary with such fundamentally different worldviews, challenging us to distinguish between those who intentionally harm innocents and those who strive to avoid such harm. This discussion isn't about justifying the distressing images broadcast globally. It's to prompt a deeper contemplation of the moral dilemmas that are facing civilized society with jihadism. In addressing extremism, it's crucial to differentiate between the majority of Muslims and the extremist. You have to emphasize the shared value of Muslims and the rest of the world and the humanity that rejects ideologies that undermine civilized societal norms. This is not merely a religious discourse, but a universal challenge against those who reject the principles of civilized conduct. Many Americans on both the right and the left want to avoid further investment in the Middle East. If the goal is to navigate away from further entanglements in the Middle East, three strategies emerge. First, Hamas as a jihadist organization necessitates a nuanced approach to its neutralization, and this is best done without American troops or American ownership. Now, this forces delegation of this sensitive task to our regional allies. This approach has to acknowledge the profound implication of Israel, who already suffer incredible trauma, will have to bear the brunt on this conflict, and they'll have to hold responsibility to navigate in the aftermath, recognizing the harsher their response paves the way for a new generation of extremist jihadists. There's no easy answer here. Only do we want the responsibility, or do we want Israel to have it? Second, I support a two-state solution, but that's very different from mandating one. If we mandate it, we are back to holding responsibility for this issue. And while I support a two-state solution, I support one based on a framework that is yet to be fully considered. The viability of any solution is challenged by the realities on the ground, including the indoctrination within Gaza of jihadism and the exploitation of its people by its leaders, which significantly hinder the path to peace. It draws parallels from the comprehensive commitment seen in post-war Japan. The success of a two-state solution would necessitate a similar dedication to establishing the rule of law and democratic capitalism, a commitment of time that the U.S. has a questionable track record on. And we're going to have to consider the idea that should we allow October the 7th to be Independence Day for Hamas? Last, establishing a credible deterrence against the impunity with which Iran operates is imperative. The reluctance to engage in new conflicts is understandable and shared. I shudder when I hear the voices wanting to expand the conflict with Iran. However, be certain of this: peace and stability in the region hinge on the clear articulation and enforcement of consequences for adversarial actions by Iran, China, and Russia. The path to peace is predicated not on withdrawal, but on a steadfast resolve to imposing significant and escalating repercussions for any aggressions. The only thing Iran will respond to is deterrence. Israel's military strength, highlighted during Gaza conflict, suggests it can enforce a significant degree of control over its region. However, the enduring question will remain: even if Israel wins the war, can it win the peace? The two-state solution, which proposes the establishment of an independent state of Palestine alongside Israel, is seen by many as a viable path to enduring peace. Yet, The actualization of this solution is fraught with complexities, namely that a large portion of population in Gaza adheres to a jihadist fundamentalist whose primary goal is that all the land in Israel should be under the control of an Islamic state. The jihadists see a two-state solution as just the first bite at the apple. They openly admit that if they gain a second state, that they're coming for the rest. Unless this fundamental view is changed, inevitably a two-state solution will end up right back where we are now, and that is someone having to go in and eradicate the radicals who exist within the government. Hamas and other jihadists will adamantly oppose incorporating Western liberal values, including human rights, equal rights, civil rights, and free markets into a potential Palestinian constitution or charter. They would also subvert that constitution if they controlled the courts that they were enforcing. They would go around it if they had the military. But these guaranteed rights of the individual, short of them striking oil, is the only way that we're going to ensure long-term self-sufficiency, prosperity, and stability. The evidence is just in on this one, and that is that those nations that adhere to the principles of the Enlightenment through civil rights, free markets, and elected governments are just more prosperous than those who are under authoritarian rule. You can see this in evidence in places like North and South Korea, where South Korea was poor and North Korea in the 1940s. Today, South Korea is one of the wealthiest nations on the planet, and North Korea is one of the poorest. This is evident in the night map that shows North Korea almost completely dark, with South Korea completely lit up. Free market principles made South Korea better. I've spent enough time in foreign policy and diplomacy to understand fully that the belief that the values of one society is better than another is considered to be ethnocentric. This word is almost tantamount to racism in today's intellectual society, increasingly that has an orthodoxy around postmodernism and postcolonialism. But as it turns out, there really are some universal truths. Some values are better than others. You know, like that one that all people are created equal, or that women should have the same rights as men. Regardless, the feasibility of a two-state solution won't work otherwise. The recent conflict has not only taken a severe human toll, but it's also polarized opinions and hardened positions on both sides. Israeli hardliners are increasingly resistant to the idea of a two-state solution, as well are jihadists, other than as a means to a one-state Palestine. This is exemplified by Gaza's support for Hamas on October the 7th. The loss of life on both sides will always be polarizing, but in the future, maybe it's justifiable if it results in both people being more secure and free from the tyranny of racial and radical jihadism that has caused so much pain. So last, we're going to look at what is happening here at home. You know, I said in the beginning, I would not defend the image of a mother pulling her child out of a pile of rubble. To those who witness the atrocities of conflict through the lens of their television screens and they cry out for peace, your sentiments are not only valid but vital. This instinctive call for an end to violence is a testament to humanity's enduring hope for peace. As I've shared previously, the brutal realities of war cannot be overstated. You should feel bad about the horrors of war. But as we explained above, this is a real war. And while you hear all the things that Israel should do, wars really only conclude after a few scenarios unfold. The first is a military defeat or surrender. This involves one side decisively defeating the other, leading to an unconditional surrender, as seen in our own Civil War and in World War II. However, such clear-cut endings are relatively rare in modern conflicts. Then you have war-negotiated settlements. Often wars conclude through negotiations where both parties come to a mutual agreement to cease hostility. This will be very difficult to reach an agreement with a group that you plan to hold accountable for the murders. An example of this was on July 27, 1953, military commanders from the United States and the Korean People's Army and the Chinese People Volunteer Army signed a Korean armistice agreement, ending roughly 3 years of fighting. A settlement is possible for the Israel-Gaza war, but I think that that will only happen when Sinwar, the mastermind, is captured or killed. Israel will not walk away from control of Gaza and allow him the ability to reorganize. And I would be surprised to see it happen with him as part of the negotiations. And then there's the war of attrition. Now, this could be a very long conflict until both sides reach exhaustion. This can happen due to a loss of personnel or resources, or the will to continue, or the economic collapse of a warring party. This is what happened in World War I. Both sides fought to a standstill. It was only the involvement of American doughboys that tipped the balance. These doughboys were so named because they didn't look like the traditional starved soldier. And then there's the overthrow or regime change. Wars can change when a government is overthrown, either by external forces or internal rebellion. The overthrow of Tsarist Russia resulted in the end of their involvement in World War I and the rise of the Communist Party. The overthrow of Hamas would create the ability to find a solution. Then again, a new group could be worse. In my last visit to Israel, we were briefed on military operations and the philosophical views of the administration on major issues, including the war, and finding a peace and a two-state solution. We spent time on the details regarding the events surrounding October 7th, including a graphic film that is nothing short of haunting. Now, I'm bound by non-disclosure agreements on certain sensitive information involving the film, but the events of this war are so central to what actually happened on October 7th that it's important to tell the story, even at the risk of repeating myself. Now, this is the shortest version of the story. On October the 7th at 7 a.m., the army of Hamas breached the wall in several places. Of the 30,000 personnel in the Gaza military, somewhere near 4,000 men, fully armed and clad in vest and masks, came through the wall. They hit the small farming community, made up mostly of kibbutz and a concert of 3,500 young people. The Israelis were completely caught by surprise. It was clear they had no expectation whatsoever of what was happening until it was too late. They were murdered through their screen doors, burned in their homes alive, their children murdered and raped in front of them, and their parents murdered in front of their children. One of the images that I can't get out of my dreams was the video of a father pushing his two young boys, maybe 8 and 10 years old, still in their underwear, to hide in their backyard. They were followed by Hamas, who used a grenade to kill their father, who did his best to shield the shrapnel from his sons. A piece of the shrapnel got past the dad and took out the eye of the younger boy. The brothers ran from their father's corpse back into the house. The older brother tried to console the younger one as he cried. They cried out loud for seeing their father die, and they held each other, expressing a deep sorrow of knowing that they were going to die. Ironically, these families were the liberals of Israeli society. They were the hippies, the peacenik, those bent on improving their lives through the hard work of the land, people who cared about the rights of Gaza that they worked next to. You know, I could show you hundreds of pictures like these families that were murdered and desecrated. And we listened to this film where these nice-looking Arab men, not even close to resembling people with mental disorders, called their moms with joy saying that they'd killed 10 Jews, and listening to the joy of their mother saying how proud they were of them. And they filmed it. They filmed all of it. The torture, the rape, the brutality. They filmed thousands of people in the streets of Gaza, cheering and filming with their phones the young women and men that were Israelis that were hostages in the backs of trucks that had been brutalized. Such recordings were too graphic for public broadcast, hint at the depth of their transgressions. In the United States for decades, women and feminists have waged a valiant battle to shatter the oppressive silence surrounding sexual assaults, a silence that has cloaked the issues in the shadows and stigma. At the heart of their struggle, the Me Too movement emerged as a call to break this very silence. Yet somehow, with overwhelming evidence, this is being muted, often by the very people who are the backbone of such efforts. You know, I've shared a report here on the Association of Rape Crisis Centers in Israel, focused on the sexual crimes committed during the October 7th war. Be forewarned if you read it. The contents of this report are harrowing, and it's going to leave an indelible mark on your conscience. The report unveils a chilling pattern of systematic rape and sexual abuse, presenting evidence that these were not isolated incidents, but they were components of a deliberate strategy of the Hamas fighters on October the 7th. At the Nova Festival, with the kibbutz community, and across the IDF bases, a horrifying narrative unfolds, revealing that many of these assaults were perpetrated collectively as gangs or groups. This report unveils a chilling pattern of systematic rape and sexual abuse. It presents an incontrovertible evidence that these weren't isolated incidents, but these were a component of a deliberate strategy of the Hamas fighters on October the 7th. At the Nova Festival, the kibbutz communities, and across IDF bases, there is a horrifying narrative that unfolds, revealing that many of these assaults were perpetrated in gangs, collectively, often in the presence of their victims, family members, or friends, magnifying the degradation and humiliation. This savagery extended to the physical humiliation of victims, both male and females, whose bodies were found bound and shackled, bearing gruesome hallmarks of genital mutilation, with oftentimes weapons fired inside of them and body parts exercised. This campaign of terror was orchestrated by Hamas. Now, this raises a profound and unsettled question. What do the values we hold dear mean if we choose silence in the face of such overwhelming evidence? Those who turn away, who deny the stark reality laid before us, even when captured on film, are going to ask, why did I avert my gaze? Why did I turn my back on the truth? The truth is coming, where we will ask this question. In fact, it's going to come sooner than we may think, though what it will be a haunting inquiry. The expectation of accountability looms large in Israel. My guess is much of the tribunals at Nuremberg that were convened to bring justice to Nazis, one can anticipate seeing these films in the future as part of this trial. However, for now, people are left to comment only on what they saw today without any true ability to put it in perspective. As bad as all this was, and as horrible as the conditions are in Israel and Gaza today, my larger concern is right here at home. The discourse in the United States towards Israel, particularly in the context of the Israel-Gaza conflict, reveals a complex tapestry of opinions and ideologies across the American spectrum. Through the debate, we find answers in America when we can honestly listen to that debate and separate ourselves from the tribal instincts of the right or the left. Then debate is constructive. I'm challenged by good people on the right and the left who, through cognitive dissonance or political expediencies, just cannot stand up to the excesses in their own party, and they cloak that by attacking the excesses of the other party. So, as this multifaceted debate encompasses various groups, each holding distinct viewpoints, shaped by their ideological leanings, their historical perspectives, and political affiliations, rages on, Jews in America are finding themselves in a paradox. On the extreme right, they're considered an inferior race, and they consider them as trying to replace them through some imagined white genocide. And on the radical left, perplexed by contradictions that Jews, and for that matter Asians, present to their ideological structure of the world being part of oppressors and victims, they can only explain it away by considering them part of the larger race, identifying them as having white privilege. If you think what's going wrong is only on the left, let me take you down memory lane with this video in 2017. They identified themselves as the alt-right. Make no mistake, this group is alive and well in American politics, and they fill my comment sections with comments about how they hate Zionism. The alt-right's anti-Israel sentiment is deeply intertwined with anti-Semitic ideologies, echoing long-debunked conspiracy theories and showcasing a profound cultural and racial animosity. This faction represents a significant, though not mainstream, opposition to U.S. policies supporting Israel. Then there's the isolation perspective. This faction advocates for a U.S. policy focused primarily on domestic issues over international engagements. Their skepticism on foreign military interventions include the U.S. support for Israel, and it's often framed as a criticism of the military-industrial complex and a belief that those actions serve specific political and corporate interests rather than the national interests. Although in its infancy, it has the echo of the conspiracy theories that blame the Rothschilds for all the world's ills. But it is legitimate to challenge the traditional U.S. foreign policy approach, including its alliance with Israel, even though I may disagree with them. For advocates of the U.S. being a force for good, we have to understand these arguments. Evidence of this includes the political maneuvering within the United States Congress, the deliberate strategy by a very small faction within the Republican caucus in our Congress that have undermined funding allocations for key international allies, including Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan. Again, notably, it's a small minority within the Republican Party, but they have exerted considerable influence by preventing the progress of relative legislative proposals to a vote on the House floor. This scenario underscores the growing influence of isolationist elements within the party, which hold the sway over its legislative agenda and its foreign policy stance. Make no mistake, this is not a Republican-only challenge. And then there are the progressive circles on college campuses. This group, particularly influenced in academic settings, often critique U.S. foreign policy through a postmodern lens, viewing global events as narratives of oppression. Their opposition to U.S. support for Israel is seen as a part of a broader stance against what they perceive as oppressive structures inherent in Western liberal values. This perspective adds a nuanced layer to the debate, challenging a conventional paradigms of international relations. This narrative leads to the ridiculous viewpoints that can be seen here in this group of students, advocating for something that is a complete contradiction to their own interest. I see this type of thing, and I thank God I'm an American. This group holding up this sign would be guilty of a crime that would get them 10 years in Gaza. And that's if they lived to get the 10 years. You know, this contributed article from a gay man from Gaza points out how in Iran being gay can result in a forced sex change operation. The laws in Gaza are the exact opposite of the values that most of these college students who are criticizing Israel have. If you look at this, you can see that there are no domestic violence laws in Gaza. Marital rape is allowed. Honor crimes were repealed in the West Bank, but they're still legal in Gaza. Adultery can be a corporate offense, and divorce for women is only allowed in very specific instances. This is for certain. The extreme left on college campuses supporting Hamas in Gaza have no idea what they're supporting. I can't for one moment believe that this really reflects their values. Yet this slide should concern all of us. Today, 20% of Americans think the Holocaust is a hoax. Now, while that is disproportionately younger people, don't lose the idea that this is just college students. It's a coalition of interests on the excesses on both the right and the left, and that makes it much more dangerous. We should all be deeply concerned about the excesses in both parties. I have found what's been happening on the left over the last decade difficult to watch. It really culminated with these three Ivy League deans who couldn't agree that if one said that there should be a genocide as Jews, that it was a violation of their conduct codes, seemingly to protect free speech. Yet they're willing to fire professors who take the position that there was a difference between men and women. They require professors to sign DEI pledges. It's not even credible that that was the reason that they couldn't support it. At Stanford, a Fifth Circuit judge came as a guest to speak to students. He was shouted down by students who talked about his raping a daughter. Worse, administrators allowed it to go on. Now, I'm not defending what he had to say, but we should all defend his right to say it. These students were not only violating the rights of the speaker, but the rights of the people who came to hear a different point of view. The marketplace of ideas is a value that should be central to universities and our places of learning. Most importantly, these students prove they don't have the academic rigor necessary to survive in a university where different ideas are proposed. My guess into why these deans got into trouble is they actually are buying into these ideologies that we're talking about. They're actually involved in promoting the ideas of post-colonialism and postmodernism, socialism, Marxism, under the cloak of social justice. But these things have nothing to do with social justice. Now, I know there are many people who look at all of this and they're appalled. But if you're pointing the finger at the new left and then question why you're not willing to acknowledge that you're back or a group of people on the right who are willing to overthrow an American election, a group of people who will openly now say that they think that a dictator is not a bad idea, people who are willing to openly talk about why free elections don't work and declare any outcome they disagree with as fraudulent, the people who attempted violence on the hollow grounds of our Capitol. If you're prepared to point your finger and ignore what's at your own back, you're really not the solution. You're part of the problem. All of these, as well as wanting to abandon NATO or the outright support for Putin in Ukraine, are derangements of the far right. But so is the 1619 Project, a derangement of the far left. Cancel culture, critical race theory, postmodernism, postcolonialism, those are all derangements of the left. If we can only see one side of the problem, then we're experiencing a derangement ourselves. What both of these groups on the far right and the far left have in common is their focus on identity and grievance politics. Look, I left the Democratic Party and I registered as an independent. There are still things I deeply agree with the left on, including civil rights, equal rights, and human rights. But I also believe in free markets and free enterprise because the evidence shows us that they work and because they too focus on the individual. The individuals who create products or who create businesses, their rights are tied up in their ability to own what it is that they create. There's a wide agreement on America's foreign policy goal to champion values that are rooted in the Enlightenment and the individual rights. Both conservative and liberal factions support NATO, Ukraine, and Israel, recognizing the challenges posed by an authoritarian regime. However, both sides find themselves influenced by their most radical elements. Conservatives hesitate to act decisively because they're deterred by the threat of backlash from a small faction in their caucus and a presidential candidate that's hell-bent on disrupting the existing government. Liberals, on the other hand, cater to a vocal minority that labels Israel as a colonizer and an oppressor, despite a broad consensus that negotiating with jihadist organizations like Hamas is untenable, and eventually against the very interest of Gazans. Despite these divergences, the mainstream factions of both the left and the right share more common ground with each other than they do with their respective fringes. Nevertheless, these extreme wings have managed to exert a disproportional influence over their party's agenda. So I'm going to end right where I began. Wars are fought over interests, not values. A nation's interest might encompass market access to procure or distribute goods. It might be the fear of an existential threat or the anticipation of external aggressions. However, we find ourselves in a rare juncture where American interests and ideals intersect, presenting a battle between the allure of nationalism with its insular spheres of influence and the governance by the rule of law, aptly dubbed the American World Order. This framework not only safeguards the sovereignty of smaller nations, but it also champions the right of the individuals. Through the lens of democratic capitalism, we observe the intrinsic link between individual rights and economic flourishing. Conversely, the national perspective, preoccupied with spheres of influence, prioritizes a hierarchy of power over the universally applied rule of law. In such a dichotomy, the U.S. may emerge as a frontrunner in the American spheres, but yet it will be China, Russia, and Iran that will predominate their respective spheres, perceiving the United States eventually as an external threat. In the face of unsettling images broadcast on our screens, individuals of all faith and beliefs, be they atheist, Jewish, Christian, or Muslim, or any other creed, consider stepping outside and cast your eyes heavenly and express a profound gratitude for being here in the U.S., but gratitude not merely for security we enjoy, but also for liberties and prosperity and the formidable strength that are endowed upon the United States. I understand our geographical position and natural endowments play a role in our fortune. However, it is the emphasis on the individual and the rights afforded to them that fuels our extraordinary prosperity. As it turns out, not all values yield equal outcomes. But the U.S. is going to have to determine if we're going to continue to play a role in the world, not as the world's cop, but in the protection of our allies and those who promote the values that we believe in. In addition to this, we have to determine if we're going to allow the continued erosion of America here at home and in our universities without at least a countermeasure to provide real data to students about how much our values have improved the human condition to a degree greater than ever before in history. The ramifications of a shift towards nationalism, isolationism, or supporting efforts like jihadism, even if you're doing it unwittingly, are profound. Eventually, the potential relegation of the dollar from its status of the world's reserve currency, diminishing our access to global markets, and the enrichment of authoritarian regimes. Those governments who in turn finance entities opposed to U.S. ideals, impacting our spheres of influences, as well as the gifts we inherited from those who came before us, and maybe even sooner than we think. In recent years, both China and Russia have engaged in sophisticated communication strategies and campaigns that are aimed at interfering with the political landscape in the United States. They're challenging the established political order. Despite possessing superior ideological propositions, the U.S. has been notably less provocative in disseminating those ideas to its efforts during the Cold War. Historically, initiatives such as Radio Free Europe have played a pivotal role in penetrating the Iron Curtain, highlighting the disparity in prosperity and governance between the West and Soviet bloc. In the contemporary digital age, the mediums of influence have evolved. The 2016 election underscores Russia's adept use of social media to sow discord amongst American voters, while China's financial investment and influence over major social media platforms such as TikTok have raised concerns about the dissemination of content that may serve its strategic interest, including an anti-Israel sentiment. Simultaneous narratives like the Putin golden billion concept, which blames the affluence of Western nations for global poverty, have gained traction. In contrast, the dominant paradigms within the U.S. academia often focused on critiques of American society and history, emphasizing themes of postmodernism and postcolonialism. The shift away from the robust promotion of Enlightenment principles and the successes of democratic capitalism, which has historically lifted millions out of poverty, indicate a need for a reinvigorated approach to international communication. The United States, by leveraging the digital platforms that now dominate global discourse, must effectively advocate for the values and systems that have underpinned its success and contributed to its global prosperity. This entails a strategic recalibration towards engaging with global audiences through contemporary digital mediums, countering misinformation, and promoting a narrative that underscores the universal benefits of democracy and free market principles. In this contemporary iteration of the Cold War, alliances are crucial. As it turns out, supporting those allies who represent what is in our best interest is synonymous with supporting those nations with our same values. While realpolitik necessitates engagement with nations divergent from our ideals, the essence of our alliances should reside with those who strive to safeguard the individual. These principles, rooted in the Enlightenment, logic, rationality, and most significantly, the individual, remain our guiding stars.
And we stand today on the edge of a new frontier. The frontier of unknown opportunities and perils. It holds out the promise of more sacrifice instead of more security. The new frontier is here.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.